Hi, I'm Connor Bronson, executive producer and sometimes host of Dev Interrupted. Before we start this week's episode, I want to ask for 2 minutes of your time that'll help us create hundreds of hours of content vital to your journey as a developer or engineering leader. We've created a super quick survey to help us understand what you like about Dev Interrupted, what you dislike, and what you want out of our podcast in general. You can find the survey linked in the show notes of the episode, so please take the time now or after the episode to help us make this a must listen for you and thousands of other developers each week. Now, on to the episode.
Okay, hey, let's give ourselves a year. Let's try to get to the million ARR mark. Let's maybe try to get 100 customers. That would, for most entrepreneurs, sounds like a hella big success. I think we did that in like early March or something. So yeah. Like, it was like, all right, holy cow, we found product market fit in 6 weeks. Like,
yeah,
like,
crazy.
Time to go.
This episode is sponsored by LinearB. Accelerate your development pipeline with data-driven engineering metrics, continuous improvement automation, and project visibility while cutting your software development cycle time in half. Sign up for your free demo at linearb.io and mention the Dev Interrupted podcast discount for a 1 month free when you sign up for an annual pro membership.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome to Dev Interrupted. I'm your host, Dan Lines, and today I'm joined by Daniel Marashlian, co-founder and CTO of Drata. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So oftentimes we start the show by congratulating the guests on their most recent funding round, but for you at Drata, it's super special. You had an amazing Series B in November of last year. You are in the realm, or actually at $1 billion valuation within 10 months into founding your company. So super, super fast. This makes Drata one of the fastest SaaS companies to ever reach $1 billion valuation mark. Awesome. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It's been a ride, that's for sure.
It is a ride that we will dive into here in a minute. Also wanted to thank you for being at Interact, our engineering leadership conference. Your video on leadership mistakes was super funny. If anyone listening has not seen it and want to check out Daniel talking about that, his most embarrassing stories as a leader, perfect for you, Daniel. Yep. Go to the Dev Interrupted YouTube. We'll put a link in the show notes. All right, so to get started here, you're an engineer by trade, but you've also founded 8 different companies, a lot of companies. So what we really want to know is, like, simple question to start out. As an engineer, how do you become an entrepreneur that is a founder of a $1 billion company?
It's a long journey for sure. Sometimes I was actually meeting with some people last night at an event out here in San Diego that I haven't seen in a bit because of COVID and whatnot. But, you know, they kind of asked me maybe a similar question, what's different this time? And on one side, it's like, nothing's different. Like I'm doing the same thing as I did prior companies that we've started. But then, you know, kind of to not fair in a way to say that, because I have almost 20 years of experience of doing this now, of lessons learned of what not to do. So, you know, compound that, that saying of get, you know, 1% better every day over, you know, almost 20 years is, I think, a big factor to that.
Right. Yeah, totally makes sense. Those 8 companies that you founded previously, can you give us a spectrum of what happened to them in terms of, like, how you look at success?
Holy cow. Well, the first one was a complete failure. It was not in technology. We actually manufactured nutritional supplements. So that was probably the biggest lesson, is stick with what you know and what you're passionate about. And in my faith, you know, aside, it's definitely technology. I mean, I don't really talk about that one too much. Like, that actually caused me bankruptcy when I was really young, when I was about 24 or so, 25. So yeah, that was brutal. And it took a long time and a long grind to get that behind me. But, you know, I think most important there, I think, was the biggest lesson of all, was stick to what you know. I even tell that to people and friends in the asking about, like, you know, stock tips or this or that. Not that we know anything about what the market is tomorrow, but it's like, I think the same way. It's like, stick with what you know. I only invest in companies I know, and that I'm like kind of customers of, because I'm like, that's actually a really good company.
That's a great tip. You know, it's always like, I'm sorry you had to go through that failure, but it's also, you know, a blessing that I'm sure has led you to where you are now. And I can really relate to that. I mean, there's all these decisions that you need to make as an entrepreneur. And I'll just use the terminology instincts. If it's in an area that you know, you have instincts and you can make quick decisions and you can hear something that's like, okay, that doesn't sound right. This does sound right. If you're in an area that you don't know, wow, everything is new and you don't have like any gut feel.
So after that one, I moved actually out here to San, I'm in San Diego. So I moved out to San Diego around that time and got on my feet and just, you know, got a great job at a firm out here. And from there, it was kind of more of a kickoff to start my entrepreneurship journey. And from there, it was B2B productivity, like an online collaboration tool, similar to Asana or Basecamp or tools like that.
Sure.
We went into social networking after that. We were, you know, one of the teams and like the people kind of, if you scroll up and down on Twitter now and all you see is images, that's probably, you know, whether you like me or hate me for that, all the photos are probably my doing and my team's doing. Wow. That we started a couple.
We have mixed feelings about it. Yeah, we like you or hate you for it.
So we put media onto Twitter back in the day, working with those teams early on. After that, it was, you know, back to kind of B2B SaaS and the survey world. And then we jumped over to the ed tech scene, which was my last company prior to Drata. And then now Drata. There's probably a couple in there I didn't mention because they were definitely like, you know, really quick failures where we would build the code, get the product out, and then like no one wanted to buy it or use it. It was like, all right, let's just shut this one down before we sink a year of our lives into it. So
fail fast.
Yeah.
Know when to pull the plug and start the next thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay, great. We're going to move into an area that's around signs that you're an engineer who should become an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And there's a quote from you that says something like, one way to know is you care more about the company that you're working for than anyone else that works there does. Could you? What does that mean?
Yeah, it was very apparent to me, even at my first job out of college, or first tech job out of college. I was working at a community college out in the Phoenix area. And, you know, I think the people that work there from the tenured professors, well, not, I mean, you know, hats off to them educating the community there. That's not really what I was talking about. It was more on my side, on the tech side, and coming in as like, you know, young, you know, like I just graduated college, I'm this young engineer. And I was just always there to soak up everything and just be a sponge and learn and help. And just all the time, you know, you just kind of saw these people that were just like, weren't really ever happy. And they're just there to like earn their paycheck and maybe eventual pension at this college. And it's just like, all right. And then, you know, so I would consistently like be, I would leave, you know, past everyone where the lights were off at the building and, you know, trying to do not only do my job and learn because I don't know as much as my senior peers, but just taking a passion in my career and helping students. And I remember the moment actually that happened was I was responsible for this, for the help desk system across the whole district there from a technology perspective. And, you know, so sometimes you'd get a bug or you would look into it. And due to that bug, you would see a couple issues from students. And I would say, oh, okay, I think I know what's going on here. Let me help this student through this technology problem they're having. So I would look up their phone number or something in the system and I'd give them a call. And I, you know, this is Daniel from whatever. And then I would help them. No big deal. That was great. They were happy. But then, you know, my boss or my dean would find out and kind of like in a way, like scorn me a bit or get me in trouble a bit. Like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? Right. That's not your role or help. And it's just like, you know, we're all on the same mission to help students and educate students. And I'm getting in trouble because that's the end goal of this. And so that was, you know, I think the wake up call where it was like, I'm trying to do good things and I'm still delivering my projects that are assigned to me as my normal job as an engineer. And I'm going above and beyond to help the end customer, the student, and get in trouble for that. I was just like, this is weird. Like I'm caring too much for this thing, especially back then. Holy cow. I think I made like I don't even know if I made 40 grand.
Yeah.
And so it's like, what am I doing here? Like, this is a little crazy.
That's an awesome story. The word that popped out for me there is like the passion that you had, even like 40 grand, who cares? That's not like obviously why you're doing that. You have a passion to help the mission or the people. I can relate to the same thing. In my first startup, when I was not a founder, I was just a little lowly engineer doing the best thing I could. I found myself at the office at like 10 p.m. on a Friday night. And the CEO coming in to like where I was working, it was like the bullpen lots, and being like, what are you doing here? And I was like, what do you mean? Like, what are you doing here? He's like, it's 10 p.m. on Friday. I'm like, oh shit, it's Friday. And it's he's like, we should go home. Like, okay, we should go. I don't have any plans. Like, and I was just working on like the product UI and like really passionate about it. And that's a really good indicator that you have that desire to start your own thing.
Yeah.
What are some of the other things listeners might recognize in themselves as signs that they could or should pursue their own path?
Yeah, I think, you know, in general, I would say if an end goal of yours is wealth, which a lot of them, you know, a lot of us have that drive, I think owning your own business is the way to wealth. I'd probably say two big avenues would be like ownership of a company and real estate. Those would be two big directions. And so real estate's definitely a slower game. It's great, and home ownership and others, investments. But yeah, I mean, you go look at, you know, go pull up the list of the richest people in the world. Very, very few of them are employees at the business. Like, you know, I don't know, Tim Cook comes to mind. Like, he didn't start Apple, but he rose over time to eventually take the CEO spot, and he's one of the wealthiest people in the world. And those are, I think, more and few far between, even though founders of very successful companies are few and far between. But of that group, it's the founders that accumulated wealth. So that was always in the back of my mind, was maybe I don't want to do that till I'm 65 or 70. So how do I get there faster? And I think, you know, through company ownership is definitely a way. So that was one for me. Another one was, I don't know, maybe it's a good or bad thing, but I'm a little control freak too, very type A, and this is, you know, how it should be done. And obviously you learn that better and better over time, but you also have a good sense from even day one of how something should be and the vision of that. And, you know, to have control and have the starting the engine of this company and setting the tone and the culture, it was always just a thing that came natural to me.
Yeah. I remember my father telling me, hey, Dan, it's all good, whatever you want to do, like compensation wise and salary. But the truth is, in the way the world works, if you do have like aspirations to be wealthy, you got to own your own thing.
Yeah.
Of course, you could be like a star athlete and maybe be a $1 billion athlete, even though they kind of own their own brand at that point. But like, if you do care about that, like you got to get significant equity into your own company.
Yeah, definitely.
And I would just, you know, add one other thing. It speaks, I think, a little bit to the type A personality. I don't think you always have to have a type A personality, but what I found is if you're working and you're able to rally people around you.
Yeah.
You have an idea, you said, okay, it should be done this way. I can get people to follow, or I have an idea and I can rally people in a direction. I think that's a really good sign that you can do it. You'd be an entrepreneur, because a lot of it is, hey, we're all going, come with me. This is where we're going. Who's coming?
Definitely. And trying to help. I mean, that is literally my favorite part of being an entrepreneur over the years, is the companies that we've built and the people and the customers or people that it's impacted and helped over the years is great, but the employees that we brought along the way and made their lives better, we're able to have them have an enjoyable experience in the work experience, gain wealth along the way. If we were to sell or IPO a company and, you know, employ all these people and impact their lives and their families. That's always my favorite part.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't beat that. I can just think of like, when I was an engineer saying like, hey, this is the way it should be designed, or this is my idea for the product. You're rallying, you're even influencing the product, or this is how we should work. So, you know, all really good signs there. What about knowing your skill set and what you can bring to the table. So you've started 8 companies, as we said. I think all of them, you're on like the CTO side, right? Engineering side.
Yeah.
Most of them. Definitely. You know, so you have that, you know, it's a great foundation to have. And you said something like you can start a company with experience. You don't need an idea.
What yeah. I mean, great ideas are great. But I think an idea is cheap. I forget who said it, or it was some video I watched. It was probably from some one of those, like, you know, leadership talk people
yeah.
over the years.
But Simon Sinek.
Yeah.
Someone like yeah, some yeah. pop culture.
and it was a great little chart they had. And it was like, it was essentially a matrix of like the value of an idea versus execution. And you could have the world's best idea. I mean, let's put Apple up there, right? Like, holy cow, they're the world's biggest company. But without execution, like, it was just an idea. And so I think it was something like, you know, the world's best idea is like worth $20. But okay, not the best idea or a mediocre idea, but with really good execution, you know, maybe that's worth $1 million or in the 8 figures somewhere. But the best idea and the best execution, that's where, you know, you start getting in that upper echelons. And so that was always striking to me of, hey, we don't need to come up with the next Apple. We just need to out-execute everyone. So sometimes you do have an amazing idea with execution, and that's led to some success in my career. But even some of the just, you know, how do I make this incrementally better? How do I build a better mousetrap? How do I put better support around it and out-execute everyone in the market? That's kind of been, I would say, maybe 80% of my career in companies has been that. It was like, here's this idea. They weren't doing it the best. I think we could do it better from a product perspective, but from a scale and support perspective and speed and of execution. So a lot of the companies I've built, it's been taking that road.
That's perfect because, well, first of all, you know, I agree, like ideas are kind, I have ideas all the time. Like, and you'll talk to, I know you can talk to, so I talk to some of my friends and it's like, yeah, I could have done this or I could have done that. I had the best idea, but it's like, no, but you got to like execute on the idea.
Yeah.
And who are the best executors of ideas or creators? Engineers.
Yeah.
Are really, it's almost in our DNA that we can, I mean, when I was like full-time developer, I was executing. I knew how to get stuff done. So, you know, kind of brings us into this area of, as an engineer, someone coming from an engineering background, what edge do you think you have on creating your own company or being a founder that you might not realize?
As an engineer, I mean, you have the ability to create something from nothing. And so as I've partnered with individuals over time in my career, I've started, again, a couple of those companies that I failed fast on. I was a solo founder. It was like, all right, you know, this didn't work, or how am I going to sell this or get it to market? And, you know, so shut those down fast. But a lot of times you partner with people that have your, you know, yin and yang type skills. And so as you partner with them, you say, okay, like, you can take these pieces on, I could take these pieces on, and I can build this from nothing. Like, I, you know, go give me a week, I'll get you a prototype. Go give me a month, I'll get you an application. And I think that's a really strong skill set. I worked with too many people, like as an advisor, or sometimes even in my career, where, you know, maybe someone had this idea and they don't know, they don't have the skill set. So I have to go pay, you know, a development firm or whatnot to get the idea actually executed. And you see, and like, usually it's these individuals that maybe saved a bunch of money. So I've seen it from, you know, you spent $40,000 on some app that you got built, to like $100,000 or $200,000 on a full-fledged kind of application, like web application. And then, you know, a technologist like me might get involved or help you. And it's like, ooh, this code isn't the best. Like, this isn't going to scale. This isn't going to work. There's too many bugs here. And so this person spent their life savings on this crap, pretty much. And I mean, it is good. It got the idea off the ground. So I do always claim that, like, it is better than nothing. That is a step function. But I just feel kind of bad, where it's like you invested this life savings away in this thing that might have failed because the engineering didn't work. And so I think as an engineer, to be involved from day one and set that ground rule and the architecture and the right way to do things from day one, it lets you execute even faster later, which is a huge, huge benefit.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, if you're an engineer, you're considering being a co-founder or starting your own company. Like I'll just take Linear B, for example. So my partner, co-founding partner and our CEO, Ori Kieran, comes from like a hardcore developer background.
Yeah.
We had an idea. Like we said, ideas are cheap. He did the first iteration of the idea essentially into a prototype. I went to all these different companies and used that prototype.
Yeah.
And we were able to visualize, let's say, the idea or bring it to life. That's how we got our first round of funding.
Yeah.
It's just like basically us too, right? And like you're saying, you get such a better jumping off point if one of the founders like cares about the code and how it's designed, you know, because you can spend the $200K. They're working with a lot of other companies too. Like they all have an end mission to make your company scalable, right?
Yeah.
So that's like, I think, invaluable to bring to the founding circle.
Yeah. And in a modern tech company that probably who's listening to this, from an iPhone app to a web application, B2B or B2C, like it's all going to be very rich in code and technology and product and design, and having someone on the founding team that knows that versus I just know how to market this or I just know how to sell this. If that's the team that's taking an idea forward, now their time is going to be, a lot of their time is spent on, you know, this outside firm, on the product, on bug fixes, on reviews, not focusing on their skill set, which is, you know, how to get this to market, how to close deals. And so that's where I think, you know, having that solo founder mentality versus, you know, a pair that maybe has different focuses and expertise is that's where you see success.
Yeah. Even better if you're an engineer that has some design or product. I mean, we can look at, you've been bringing up Apple. Did Apple invent the MP3 player? Did Apple invent, you know, like a smartphone? No, they just like, it has the best experience possible.
Yeah. I mean,
if you're bringing that to the table, like you should join you should either start your own company or be very confident that you can be a technical founder with that design.
I can't think of a better example of Apple. I mean, they're obviously the biggest success that we all look up to, but, you know, Jobs, while maybe he started this and had this idea, he wasn't alone. And I think we put certain people on pedestals, in these success stories, you know, from Microsoft to Apple to even Facebook, like none of them did it alone. You know, Zuckerberg didn't start it alone. He had three other founders with him. So while there, and that's great, like put the CEO or the lead person on the pedestal for the market and the public, but how it actually got done on the inside was not, you know, a single person. So I think that's the key takeaway for me, is that leader in a lot of those examples had an amazing product vision, and they were essentially head of product in the early days. And you know, it's like, hey, engineer or my partner, this is what we kind of want to go to, and let's go build it. And as it, you know, it's maybe two of you or four of you to start, and you get those first levels down, then you could start bringing other people, like you said, raise an early seed funding so you can bring other people in.
Absolutely. If you want an inspiring, have you read the book I Was? This is like Steve Wozniak.
I haven't, but I know.
It's a good, like, if you want an inspiring, like, I'm a true engineer, entrepreneur, but I, you know, everyone knows Steve Jobs, but check out I Was. This dude is inventing things and, like, I guess doing it in a way where him and Jobs really together, the experience is incredible. Yeah. But without Wozniak, there's like, it's not happening.
Yeah.
All right. So what skills do engineers possess that you use most as a founder? So not even necessarily like something super technical, but there's any skills that like you gained as an engineer that now you're at the founder status, you're at the founder table. Like, do you use anything that you learned in the past?
Yeah, I would say the top skills that I feel like I have, I guess, would be two things. One is almost like project and program management. How do you execute at that lightning pace? And as you grow and it's more than just two people, and then it gets to, hey, now I have an engineering team of six or 10, and then you grow that to 30, and then you grow that to 100. there's those different levels of just project management and continue that level of execution when it was just two or three of you. That's been probably
very tough.
Yeah, that's probably been the hardest challenge. And so really driving that culture of how to use whatever project management tool that you have and how to set up a process that's not holding people back and just like process for process, but it's just enough to continue the ball moving forward as fast as possible when you know it's not just you doing it. So I would say that's been one I don't know if I've perfected it, but it's pretty good as, you know, proof in the pudding a little in Drata. But so that's been, I think, a really strong skill over time that I've had is just how to get code to production. That's what I definitely focus on. I think that last 10% of the job is the hardest 10% of getting something to production. Like development is, in my opinion, 50% of any, here, let's build this feature. Great. The actual code is 50%. And the other 50% is just getting it through the process and eventually to production. And that last little 10% of it is, I think, the hardest part. And that's where engineers, all in all, no offense to all y'all, but as a collective whole, we kind of suck at that. Like we think, hey, I did my part. Like it'll get there. It'll magically, you know, be there. And it takes a lot to get it out and get it out with quality and speed. So I think that's something
we're always working on it as a community.
Yeah. I mean, obviously Linear B helps get there. It's a little plug there, but you know, I always look at things right to left. A lot of us use a tool like Jira or whatever. And a lot of us have like a Kanban, you know, kind of columns of your stages. And when I look at those boards, I always talk about, you know, from standups to end of month, or like literally today's our last day of our quarter at Drata, where month shifted. So it's like, there's these major projects we're literally trying to get out today, maybe tomorrow, but it's like, let's always look right to left. Let's always say, hey, this piece, I could spend 2 minutes of my day and get this one ticket to the next step versus start something new. I've always said like to the engineers, even though it's not realistic, but it's like, when you look at that very left column, treat that as it's worth a dollar to the company. The very right column where it's closed and it's on production based on however many steps, just put a 10x multiplier as you keep going. So sometimes, like, I think I forget how many steps we have, but it's like, it's worth $10 million to the business if this one ticket goes to production. And so do you want to spend 5 minutes trying to help the $10 million problem, or, you know, an hour trying to spend the dollar problem? Like, so always think right to left.
I love that mindset. I would say one of the things that I've seen for founders that were engineers, sometimes you're like partnering with people that are a little more on, let's say, like the sales side or like business side.
Yeah.
And there might be a big vision and a really cool vision. But what I find engineers, like the engineering founders, really good at is like breaking down the vision or breaking down the problem set into small iterable chunks.
Yeah.
And that's what I always see kind of when I'm either talking to Ori, like I, you know, my founding partner, or like some of our like most skilled engineers. It's like, okay, Dan, like, yeah, okay, we want to do this. Like, now let's break it down. What is it? Like, how can we make it happen? Yeah. That's invaluable.
Yeah, that's definitely an art form, I would say. Like in the engineering process, there is hard science and like, you know, measurable items, but that estimation, the breakdown, how do we iterate on this? That is an art form that you have to, in the sine wave of everything, kind of eventually you figure out a even bar in there, and you can estimate pretty accurately, and you can really then, based on velocity of your team, and we're really good at estimates, we're really good at breaking things down as a team overall, you really can get to like March 17th, we're going to have this done, right?
And then predictability.
That just helps the front of the go-to-market team, like preparing the support, preparing the marketing, preparing the sales team. And, you know, without that really estimate guess versus like, it'll be done when it's done, like then your front of house team can't move as fast.
Yeah. It's momentum. Like if you have predictability, I don't want to veer too far off, but yeah, predictability matters because it gets like momentum for the entire business. Okay. It sucks when there's not predictability. Everyone like loses morale in that. I just call it momentum to go to market, basically.
I love that. Yeah, I would say one more skill is, and this is maybe just me, more of a, I definitely, you know, have skills up and down the stack from the servers to JavaScript, but I think that like database foundation and code pattern architecture, like that's where I've definitely been able to jump into a project. I might not be involved in the code and the code reviews, but at the end when it's all kind of ready and maybe I just want to do a one last pass and review with someone. So sometimes that happens at the end based on just, I don't know, how crazy my day is. Sometimes before we even write one line of code and looking at their proposed architecture, it's, I think, being able to jump in, not like understand the product and the project at a really high level, just see what a proposed architecture is and say, you know, fix 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
And so I think having that skill set and just be able to jump in, give really quick moments of advice, that's helped us save a lot of time moving forward.
Yeah, I was going to say, when I see someone with that skill, it's a speed thing. It's like, design it this way from the beginning so that, you know, like 2 months from now, we're not coming back and saying, oh, you know how we're not hitting our deadlines? It's because we have to re-architect this thing that we kind of fucked up in the beginning.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk a bit about how to find good founders. If you're starting a company, of course, the first place that you should look, apparently, if it's you, is Craigslist. I've never heard. Is this a real? Do we have a real story? Okay, what is up?
Story.
What is up with Craigslist and finding? That's not
the well. I think Craigslist, when was that? 2007, I think. It's maybe a little different than now.
Yeah,
maybe not though. I don't really go on Craigslist anymore.
So. I mean, for me, it was always a weird place to be. I sold a few guitars in a parking lot on Craigslist.
Yeah, poor Craig. I don't think his name is used well anymore. But I was younger entrepreneur and wanted to get into the scene. And, you know, from going to local community events to just looking everywhere. And I was like, I wonder if anyone's posting on Craigslist. And I saw this random post and it was just like, this person A doesn't seem like a weird creeper. B, like it was a good idea and that he had a, you know, decent background and he was in San Diego where I was. And it was like, all right, let's go meet with this guy. And it happened to be my colleague and actually now a colleague at Drata. He works with us here now. But awesome. He runs our international growth at Drata now. But Troy Malone is his name. And he had this great idea. He was a former VC, eventually took on the COO role at one of the companies they invested in. And it was a smaller like video production type company. And how can we improve, you know, everything, right, as an operator? And then I think in, you know, 2006-ish or whatever, he found Basecamp. And this was like, I mean, those guys over at 37 Signals still write an amazing product. But back then, they were kind of the leaders and inventors of this Web 2.0 movement after the dot-com crash. And they had this product called Basecamp for group collaboration. It was one of the first, I would say, like B2B SaaS companies out there. And he found it really helped change their business around, and that was great. But then after working with it for a year or two or whatnot, it was like, this is wrong. And I think Jason over at 37 Signals back then, I don't know if he is still now, but he was pretty notorious for not listening to his customers. It was a strategy they took. And I think it kind of pissed Troy off in a way where he's like, I could do this better. And so that was the journey that eventually I met Troy on, is he was the one that went and spent $100,000 on getting this first version built by an outside offshore team and, got something together, which I commend him for. But then eventually, you know, he, I think, realized he needs that technical founder and put a posting out and I saw it and we met and it was a match made in heaven. Because then we went on to build that company, raise money. We were killing it for the time. I think we were too early. Now you look at companies from Trello to Asana to ClickUp. We were a little too early on that one. It eventually we closed shop there after raising some money, but we had great company. We had Warner Brothers. We like the movies that were being produced at Warner Brothers are being managed by Pelotonics was the name of the company. There's a really big hospital here in San Diego. The team that built that actually used Pelotonics to manage the project plan for the hospital. It was cool stuff. But the point there was, we met Troy. We eventually shut that business. He went on to lead growth at Evernote for a while. I went on, did some other stuff. And as we built Drata, and we always kept in touch because, you know, it's like a second brother at this point. He just loved what we were doing and came on to run growth, international growth here at Drata. So it's so fun to work with him again.
I'm so happy to hear that he's at Drata with you now. That's like the best part of the story. So what's the takeaway here? Go to Craigslist to find your...
Craigslist is maybe an avenue. I would say over the past 15 or whatever years, there's definitely other venues to maybe go to first. There are, I forget some of the co-founders lab. I forget. There's some cool sites out there that are just like, this is my skill and this is an idea and I'm looking for this skill. And it's like this like dating for founders. There's some apps out there.
There's a bunch of them now and there's meetups and if like you're in any, you know, decent city, you'll find like there's meet and greet type
stuff. Just, you know, networking. Like I always heard that when I was young and like maybe a little bit more introverted. I was younger. I've definitely become a lot more extroverted in my adulthood, but you know, it's like your aunts or whoever, maybe that were in, you know, some corporate job. They're like, you got to network. And you're just like, all right, old lady, but now I get it. It's like, go put yourself out there. And I mean, that's the story of my second group that I co-founded the company with. Was it was through my network that I heard about a pair of co-founders solving this amazing, or had this amazing idea around Twitter and around photos. And this was really early Twitter days. And as we worked with them and eventually built up Tweet Photo, and then eventually changed the name to Plixi. But that was the same story there. It was through LinkedIn and Twitter and the San Diego community and getting intros there. So I think it's always just, you know, you never know, and just be overly nice to people and keep those relationships up. And it's always a give and take. Like, it's like, hey, I'm here for advice on my technical side, you know, and vice versa. And you could always ask people for advice or, hey, do you know anyone? I'm looking for my next job. Versus just doing an off the street kind of, you know, interview. I think those mutual intros of trust in that community is where it is. So that's kind of the story of my second company. Is that's how I got introed there, was through Twitter.
What do you think is, if I'm like a engineering, you know, founder, what do you think I should look for in my founding partners? Like behavior, skill set, like what have you found that's good or maybe not so good too?
Yeah. I think it definitely depends, in my opinion, on B2C versus B2B. In the B2B world, this is a lesson I learned hard on a company we started with the photo guys. We all started a company after that acquisition and whatnot. Was none of us were none of us were the sales guy, right? And so we, you know, from engineering and product to, you know, our CEO was more on the BD and product side, and our other founder was on the marketing side. It was very apparent sales was a missing. So we built an amazing product. It worked. We got some great BD deals where it was driving traffic through. Like it was a survey product. So on average, like Google consumer surveys, they're like 4% completion rate or so, somewhere in there. And we were getting above 85% completion rate. So it was like easy, mobile, native, like it was great. It was really cool. The problem was like companies like SurveyMonkey and all those like Qualtrics, whatever. Holy cow, they have, you know, B2B, not only the leaders in sales, but a sales force. And as we go up against them in deals, none of us wanted to just pick the phone up every day, you know, be essentially outbound SDRs, and like it just wasn't our thing. And that was the eventual demise of that business. I eventually sold it to one of our competitors for the IP, but that was a big awakening. And that's where when I found I was in an incubator with that, and that's how I found Adam Markowitz, my co-founder and CEO. Now he was in another company, and as we went into that, it was like, wow, the not only skill set of this individual on the product thought, and leadership and sales thought was like, wow, like this is awesome. He can do that side where I can take on the tech side. And we actually brought in now our co-founder, Troy. There's another Troy. Troy's a rare name. And now we have two Troys. We actually have three Troys at Drata, which is the Troyfecta is what we call them. But so Troy Markowitz, our other co-founder at Drata, he is, holy cow. I kind of call him, the Daniel on the sales side. He is a beast, like top 1% sales guy in the world. not like that cheesy, you know, car salesman, get the deal done, just like really values, you know, what your initiatives are and outcomes, and just is unbelievable at closing deals. So once I saw that happen at Portfolio, and then, you know, we all started Drata together. I mean, you know, hats off to Troy. That is a huge reason of success of both those companies. And that was, to me, the biggest lesson I would say over my past 10 years is, as a technical entrepreneur, ensure that your, you know, counterpart, whether it's an individual, a single person or a couple people, like at least one of them is just like a killer salesperson.
Yeah. And I would just like add on to that. Sometimes you, as an engineer, are kind of like adverse, I guess, to salespeople, especially if they're kind of like lame or like, I got to find the best word for it. But you can find salespeople that have that great skill and strategy that are totally in on your mission. They get it. They get what you're trying to do. All right. So we're going to talk a little bit about what to expect from entrepreneurial life and kind of this relentless execution. It's probably safe to say you're someone that works really hard. I mean, how do you think about, you know, executing, you know, effort? And I think you're also quoted saying, if it takes 10,000 hours to learn a skill, it's up to you if you want to do it in a year or three.
Yeah. I think a year might be aggressive. That I don't even know if there's that many hours in a year. I'd have to go do the math on that. But, you know, I think, yeah, whether the saying is 10,000 hours to master skill or 1,000 days, I'll give that quote up actually to my good friend and our head of QA. He uses that on a lot of people we hire in on the QA side. It's like, it's up to you if you want to master this skill in, you know, maybe 2 years versus three or four. It's about putting the hours in. And I think it is very true. It takes about 3 years to master a skill if you dedicate towards that. So in that effort, I'm not saying, hey, everyone works 16 hours by any means, but I do value that you have to if you want to do it faster. So in that way, if you want to go on this journey, it's a long, isolated, relentless journey where your friends are going out, you can't go out. Or if you do go out, you're coming back, maybe you only have one drink, not five, and you're coming back and picking it up till 4 a.m. And it's just nonstop. And I've been doing that now for, 15 plus years on that thread. And I mean, you know, again, hey, it's paid off. But at the same time, there was moments in my personal life, you know, from family to dating to whatnot, where it didn't work out. And, you know, luckily my wife, when I, you know, first met her, she kind of knew the crazy entrepreneur I was. And I always made time for that, which then really just ate into my sleeping time. I also think some people at their biology level can sleep less. I forget the actual word for it, but I don't think I need the full 7-8 hours.
A mutant.
Yeah.
They call it.
A lot of people I know actually call me an alien. They don't think I'm
there.
Because I think four or five hours I can operate. If it's like 2 or 3 hours, I'm a zombie for sure. But that 5 hour mark, I'm good. So I think I can use that to my advantage in that. And yeah, I mean, as I was building that tweet photo company, I met my wife or girlfriend at the time, but then always stuck through it. And I mean, there was for sure moments even in our relationship where it almost died because it was more about her caring about me, like you are on this journey and you need to spend more time on that. And obviously we continued and figured that out, but she's the best. But yeah, it's brutal. So, it's been funny, like over time and in my current group, founders, I was the first one to get married out of all those. So, Maggie, my wife, she's always been like the, you know, like wise, like wife or mom of all the other girlfriends. How do you do this? Like, how are you married yet Daniel works 15 hours a day. Bless her for sure. But, it's been rough. So I think that's a really important part is if you do, decide to partner up with someone, during this journey, it's like, ensure they know the future and ensure they know what they're getting into and how you can support each other. I mean, I love that story. I mean, sadly now they're broke up for whatever reasons, but yeah, Jeff Bezos and his wife, it was like, like she was supporting him while he, you know, like they flip-flopped, I think in their careers, like in the early days he was supporting her. But then when he had this vision, she was supporting him while he's building Amazon. And like, now look at Amazon, holy cow. Sometimes we all put Jeff on the pedestal. I put his ex-wife on the pedestal for supporting him to start that, for sure.
The one tip that I have, and okay, I'll say what I did wrong. I used to live by what the notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls, said, which was keep your work and your family completely separated. And that's true if you're, what you're doing for work is a risk to your family's health. Okay.
Definitely.
But one change that I made after talking to one of our product leaders leading our Worker Bee product, Ofer, is I think, and I'm doing this now and it's working much better, bring your family close in. Hey, here's what I'm going through at work. Here's what we're building. Here's the challenges that I'm facing. Here's who I'm interviewing. Here's who I just hired. Here's what I'm worried about. If you bring it in, now it's like, okay, we're in this together. You know, yeah. Your partner, your wife, your spouse, your kids, we're doing this together. This is what, and this is why, oh, I have to be up at 5 a.m. It's because like, I'm really, you know, just be open. I'm really nervous about an interview. I would love to bring this person, but I've never, oh, okay. And that is something that I think can help with the relationships.
Definitely. I think, you know, it's best said where it's like, do I want to work 16 hours a day? I mean, sometimes what I do, it's fun. I mean, I do enjoy developing. So when I get in that mode, cool. But it's like, do I want to work 16 hours? Do I want to wake up at 7 or take a call at 2 a.m. with someone in Israel? Like, no, I don't. Like, I'd rather maybe go watch the Suns game or so, I don't know, whatever. But it's, I have to do this because this is what we're on and this is the end goal. So I think as if everyone, like you said, if the family knows that you would rather spend time with them, but for now you have to do this. It's as long as everyone's on that same mission page.
Yeah, they're in it with you.
Yeah.
Last topic, and we'll wrap it up here, is around, I guess, resiliency. You know, what are the most common issues that you faced as an entrepreneur? How do you, you know, what are the bumps to expect along the road, and how do you stay resilient to these?
Yeah, bumps? I think a really good lesson is have really strong foundational finance in the plan of the business. So you can forecast the future from headcount to projected sales and whatnot. So that just, you know, that statement just goes down and down and down. From the engineers understanding what they can deliver when to how the sales can do that in the sales pipeline of, you know, deal inspection and estimates of closing, all the way up to that financial plan and moving forward. So when you realize these future scenarios and you're like, we're not going to make it. We have 20 employees. Like, we need to maybe let go of 5 or do XYZ. So always having 2 to 3 backup plans, like that's usually always the last backup plan is, you know, letting people go. But it's a reality sometimes. I remember one time in Portfolium, we had about 30 something, 35 ish employees. And there was a moment in the company where we're like, we might need to let go of like 60% of the staff. Mm. Like, this is nuts. But, you know, luckily we figured it out and we didn't need to do that. But that was, you know, I think without really having that foresight of sales and that at that moment in time, and I don't think I think we might have made the wrong decision. So I'm glad we had that. That's one of them. I would say culture is probably like the number one thing. That's what Adam and myself have always focused on the past two companies is like, culture isn't, I mean, it maybe starts top down because it started with 2 or 3 people, but you know, as you interview in the interview process, you interview people for these cultural values that your business holds. And then that starts to, you know, snowball down to other individuals, day in day activities. We actually have on Slack, we have a high fives channel, and that's my favorite channel for sure. It's, you know, nothing that no one gets money for it or praise or whatever, but it's just working with your peers. And how does one of your peers hold up one of the values at Drada? And that is just littered with messages every day. It's so cool to see. So I think by having that amazing culture, look, everything right now at Drada is up and to the right in an extreme way. And it's really fun. I mean, it's intense, but it's really fun. But it's not always going to be like that in our future. And so as you, you know, maybe flatline, hopefully we never go down, but see flatline a little is, you know, I think the culture will really shine, and that momentum with your peers and making sure that everyone holds the same values. That's to me the number one thing of what holds a company not only together, but helps the company grow and get through those things that you were just talking about.
And that leads to our perfect final question. Did you have a this is it moment, a moment where you knew Drata was going to be, you know, everything you hoped it would
be? Yeah, I would say probably two moments in there. One was before we even wrote one line of code. We definitely went on not only a research, you know, project, is this a viable market and idea, but on the product tour, you know, hey, we built some prototypes and, you know, design, took that around from the smallest companies in the world, 1, 2, 3 people, all the way up to actually the CISO of Charles Schwab and everyone in between. Like, what is this problem and how are you solving it? What are the pains? What are the successes? Who are the competitors? Things like that. And as we kind of went through that motion on that product tour, it was like, there's a real problem here. This isn't like some silly idea that we have that we experienced at our own company. That's, you know, that was kind of the first story of Drata, is
sure.
Me going through that SOC 2 process. I was like, this was painful. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, like, I remember it too.
As an engineer, how do we automate this thing, yeah, right? And that was the where it started. But it was like, well, there is a big problem here. And I thought, going into these, like, you know, we got acquired, that security team at Instructure from the last company at Portfolium was awesome. Like, man, the leader was amazing. One of the best security leaders I worked with. Their security engineers were super smart. And I felt bad because once, and then I got, you know, we got Portfolium under the SOC 2 canvases, was their big learning management system. We got under their SOC 2 process. And it was like, that's cool, whatever. But like, I felt bad for the security engineers, compliance engineers. It was like they were spending half their time just taking screenshots and like Jira tickets and corralling 1,200-1,300 employees to get through this thing. And it was, you know, and that's what I did when it was like 40 people at Portfolio. And so it was like a lot easier. And I just felt really bad. It's like, you have these highly skilled, trained professionals. They should be securing like Instructure, the company, not corralling, you know, herding cats to get screenshots. And so that was to me the biggest thing where it was like that, along with the eventual product tour. And then we put it to work. We built it. We set out in 2020. We started in the early 2020 where we incorporated. We were in stealth for about, you know, 5-6 months. And when we launched in the middle of January of 2021, I think we had like a couple even beta customers, like a little right before we like publicly launched. And, you know, I think as a young company, no funding, trying to put a dent in a new industry that none of us have been in. I mean, I've been a security engineer my whole life because I had to be, but that was never my like title or profession. So I knew the industry and I knew the tools and methodologies, but I've never built a company for the cybersecurity industry. And so new industry, you know, new people to sell to. Okay, hey, let's give ourselves a year. Let's try to get to the million ARR mark. Let's maybe try to get 100 customers. That would, for most entrepreneurs, sounds like a hella big success. I think we did that in like early March or something. So yeah. it was like, all right, holy cow, we found product market fit in 6 weeks. Like,
yeah,
like,
it's crazy.
Time to go. And that's where you saw the acceleration of our A round. And even shortly after that, the B round, because that acceleration hasn't stopped.
Amazing. Daniel, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. It was awesome to have you back with the Dev Interrupted world.
Thank you for having me.
We always like to give our guests an opportunity to promote something that they're working on. And I know that you have a new product called the Trust Center.
Yeah.
What's up with Trust Center?
For sure. So if for those that you don't know even what Drata is, we help companies automate your security compliance programs from SOC 2 to ISO 27001. We even deal with the HIPAA laws around health, PCI for the payment industry, in the privacy world, the European standard of GDPR, even over here in California, CCPA. But I mean, it's like acronym soup. But you know, name the acronym, there's a cert for it. But what happens, so we do that. We help, you know, thousands of customers achieve that milestone they're on. And it's a lot of times it's very internal. It's very, the compliance team's managing it. They use the tool to then collaborate with the auditors and make that process very easy and painless. What the Trust Center is a forward-facing public page, very similar to, say, your uptime status page that you see on all so many sites. It's like, what's the status of this company, right? A lot of companies, you know, you're not going to like post your public data dog dashboards of what to the market. It kind of, you know, maybe summarizes in a status page. So very similar to a status page, it's your security page, it's your trust center, it's your trust page. So it's a, you know, a CNAMED page on your domain that really represents the current real-time status of your posture, of your security posture, and the monitoring of the, you know, your business controls, as well as a really easy way for your prospects to request those certificates or reports, your SOC 2 report, your pen test summaries, your architectural diagrams, like automatic NDA. You know, you might request these private files, NDA gets sent to you, you digitally sign it, come back, automatically get those, you know, files that you requested to help those deals move forward faster. So many compliance and CISOs, teams and CISOs out there, man, especially in the mid-market, they might get 400 of those a year. And we want to automate that and just say, hey, you don't even need to think about that anymore. So it's an amazing product that that we launched this May, and looking forward to helping everyone get ready on and launch Trust Centers.
Well, we love Draw That Linear B, and definitely resonating with you with all the requests for compliance and this and that. So everyone be sure to check out the Trust Center. Amazing, amazing product. A quick reminder for our listeners, if you haven't already rated and reviewed the show on your podcasting app of choice, particularly Apple Podcasts, please do so. Reviews are a crucial way that our show gets discovered. Also, be sure to join the Dev Interrupted Discord community, where we keep the conversation going all week long. I want to say thank you to more than the 2,000 of you who are now subscribed to our weekly interruption newsletter. And any piece of information that we discuss in the pod today will be available in links. And one more time, Daniel, thank you so much for joining the show today.
Thank you.